Welcome back, everyone. In case you've forgotten, this is SAGPA. I'd like to take this opportunity to remind everyone of the topic for next week, which is evolution and creationism. It's a two-part presentation. It's sure to be very lively. So Thursday, April 3rd, same time, same place. And at any time, if you want to know what's going on at SAGPA, you can look at the website. The upcoming schedules are posted there, as are audio from past talks. And there are also discussion boards where you can weigh in on the discussion online if you were unable to attend the presentation. All right, so very shortly I will ask Dr. Jansen to come back up to the podium and people can ask questions. There are two things that you need to remember. First, if you have a question, please come up to the podium and speak into the mic so that we can record the audio. Keep your comments very brief and don't forget to ask a question at the end of your question. And please keep your questions limited to just a few. All right, I think I'll invite Dr. Jansen up here.
I'll try to do better speaking to the mic, too. I was standing back. It's not tall enough for me. That's the problem.
My name is Bob Anderson. I'm here because I've been delegated by our table to be the first one. Now, if you look at our table, you'll notice who did that. John Boris is historically always the first person, but he's decided to get someone else to do that. So that's the only reason I'm here. But I do have a comment and a question. If you look at the provinces on each side of us, they change their governments back and forth with some consistency from left to right, and they seem to have more or less normal people. I'd be interested in your analysis of what's wrong with Albertans from a socio-cultural, anthropological, political point of view. What's wrong with the species we've got in Alberta?
Wow, thanks, Bob. Well, if I had the definitive answer to that, like that's the million-dollar question about Alberta. There's a couple of things. The first thing, when you look at Alberta, Alberta has a really odd combination of, we do tend to vote for our government in pretty high numbers, right? Unlike other provinces, that's pretty high. But what's unusual about Alberta is our opposition is so fragmented. If you look at the number, we had four parties, each of which got 5% or more of the vote, Liberal, NDP, Alliance, and Green, whereas in British Columbia and in Saskatchewan, the opposition's been able to coalesce around one of the other parties, and that just hasn't happened in Alberta. Tricky question. I think the Conservatives have been very good at sort of occupying the middle of the road. When I look at the kinds of policies of the Stelmach government, I mean, they spend money like they put an NDP government to shame, quite frankly, for how they spend money. So they're very middle of the road in terms of a lot of their policies. So all the opposition is very fragmented. And if you look in Saskatchewan and British Columbia, the parties are sort of on one side of the political spectrum or the other, not firmly in the center. As far as the broader cultural thing, I mean, I'm a political scientist, not a sociologist, anthropologist, or all those other noble disciplines. I think part of it, there's a culture of complacency in this province, right? I think people just get very satisfied and aren't particularly critical. I've noticed that in the stance of the media in Alberta when I compare it to what I see federally or other provinces. The media here can be almost fawning sometimes in the way they deal with the provincial government, which I don't see in other jurisdictions. The media usually likes to go out and get the government, and here I just don't see that. So there's sort of a lack of a critical mentality. Where that comes from, I don't know. If you look at Alberta socially, Alberta's a lot more heterogeneous than people give it credit for. Alberta, Edmonton, Calgary are racially very diverse. Most of the people don't work for oil and gas, work in the service industry, right? People sell things to each other. That's like most other provinces. So I know I'm giving you a very unsatisfying answer, and to cut it short is I don't know entirely. But to me, when I look at the results, it's the fragmentation. It's that inability to coalesce around somebody. The Liberals just haven't been able to do it after, I think, several kicks at the can here to try to coalesce around various leaders. It just hasn't worked. And that's always been the problem, is we just haven't had that clear alternative. We had the same problem with social credit until Peter Lougheed came along in 1967 and managed to coalesce the opposition. And until that happens, I don't see a lot of change in the future.
Thank you very much. I'm Bridget Pasteur, part of that fragmented opposition. I would like to just make an observation for something that Dr. Jensen had said, and then I really would like your comment on that, if you wouldn't mind. You spoke about the all-party committees, and what basically has happened is that when they said that they were dividing up the committees, they actually have five committees, but those five committees have been taken out of cabinet, and they report to cabinet, which is a whole pile different than an all-party committee that I did sit on, where, in fact, we then report to the legislature. And it can be changed very, very easily within the legislature. And the other thing is that within that all-party committee, of course, you're outnumbered usually about 7-1. So it on the surface, I think that it looks good. But most of the stuff that was discussed with this new party, I was one of the first ones, I was on the very first one that ever sat in terms of this new way of doing things. But what happened was that we were discussing legislation that was so poor that it couldn't have got passed. So that's why it came back to our all-party committee to level it out and talk about a few things. And then it went back through the legislature. And again, it was even discussed and changed a little bit within the legislature. So there's huge differences between cabinet committee and an all-party committee. So I would really like your comment on that, or where you think that, although it looks good, how do we actually get power within all-party committees?
I realized about halfway through the talk that I was trying to do probably about five talks worth into one here, so I had to sort of go through that. The dominance of power in cabinet is, I think, almost an unavoidable part of parliamentary democracy. I mean, we see it. Every province struggles with this. Federal government struggles with this. To strengthen all party committees, there's a bunch of ways to do it. I think I think one of the things we should also look at, I could have thrown this as well, but I already had too much, is I think we need to make the legislature bigger. I think we need more MLAs, which is not a particularly popular thing to say because people think MLAs are just sponging off the rest of us, but I'm actually one of the people who thinks they're a pretty good bargain for how much we pay them. I'm sure you'd agree with me on that.
But to the other side, I certainly do.
but part of the problem is when you have a cabinet of 25 people and a government caucus of 72. If that was bigger even, then a lot of the MLAs would realize that, you know, I'm probably never going to make it into cabinet. And so there's not much point of me basically sucking up to the government, frankly, sucking up to the premier. There's no real purpose in it because no matter how hard I work or how good a job I do, I'm not going to be able to get into cabinet. So I have to find other ways to make my time more productive. So I think we need to look at the whole incentive structure for MLAs and for the course of their political careers so that their work in the legislature actually is meaningful. And this is the best it's going to get. So I might as well concentrate on being a good legislator and work hard in the legislature and on the committee. So I think it's part of the whole, just the whole incentive structure that we have for members of the legislature and MPs in Ottawa. I think also parliamentary legislative committees also need to have more research capability, more funding. They need to have staff. They need to have more of an independent existence, so they're not entirely dependent. The government decides when to use them or when not to use them. I think they need to have the ability to initiate investigations, to initiate things, not just to respond when someone decides, oh, now we're going to call them into action. This, I mean, the Stelmach government was a step in the right direction, and that's why I'm giving him some credit for that. It's something Ralph Klein steadfastly refused to do. So it's better, but it has a long ways to go. So I guess I want to give it some time as these things sort of get their feet on the ground and both members of the opposition and government get more used to operating in the structure. A lot of times these kinds of institutional changes can kind of take a life of their own as people learn how to use them and learn how to use the rules. There's all kinds of creative ways that people can cooperate across party lines. One of the great things about committees is they're less formal, they get less scrutiny, and they create more opportunities for cooperation across party lines, and I think that's what's valuable about it.
My name's Cheryl Bradley, and I was interested in your comment that the culture seems to be changing, and it, of course it is changing in terms of flow of information and use of the internet and people being more, having more opportunity to become directly informed about issues and what positions they would take on them, and therefore maybe a little less willing to trust that one person is going to represent all their interest. And I think you were suggesting that proportional representation is the way to start to address that. Right?
One of the ways.
But I guess I'm wondering, obviously Ontario and BC have tried to go down that road and yet failed so far. And I'm wondering if you can give us an analysis of why citizens didn't grasp that option.
Well, the first point to make is in British Columbia, actually 58% of voters did actually vote in favor of the PR system, but the government, in an attempt to stop this from happening, said ahead of time you needed 60%. But the result was close enough, which is why they're having to hold another referendum. Ontario was soundly defeated. There's a couple of issues. The first thing is the process used in BC and Ontario is the Citizens Assembly, which is what my students here are trying to do with the petition that they have, and the petition is going to be outside if you're interested. The Citizens Assembly, the problem with the way it's been structured is basically politicians and political considerations are excluded. Politicians are not allowed to be members of the Citizens Assembly, and there's actually very little dialogue between members of the Citizens Assembly and politicians. So what happens is they have all these discussions, and I've had a chance to hear speeches and talk to some of the people who've participated in these. I know the research staff, people who have helped to run these, and citizens take them very seriously and work hard and do the best they can, and it's actually almost inspirational hearing them talk about their experiences. The problem, though, is that by excluding politicians, the kinds of decisions they make don't connect to the real political world. In the end, elections are fought by political parties who have particular interests. And so when it gets out to the real world, it isn't well grounded in the real politics of the party system. So in BC, they chose a single transferable vote option, and a lot of people didn't like it. The NDP and the Greens, who had been fairly pro-electoral reform, that's not the system they would have chosen. And so they didn't really campaign in favor of it. The Liberals decided to stay out of it. So you just didn't have that support on the ground. But despite that, it almost happened. The Ontario case, the reason it didn't happen, I think, is just because in Ontario, they didn't have the kinds of problems that British Columbia did. Ontario has had reasonably proportional kinds of outcomes. I mean, all single-member plurality elections distort the outcome. But Ontario, the situation wasn't as bad, and they hadn't had any overwhelming majority where you didn't have enough opposition like British Columbia had in 2001, and you didn't have a situation like BC had in 1996, which is the wrong winner phenomenon, where the party that finishes second in the popular vote actually forms a government, Glenn Clark's NDP. Fewer people voted for them than voted for the Liberals, but the NDP ended up forming the government. So they never had any of those anomalous problems. I think another problem that we get is the details of electoral systems, although I find them endlessly fascinating, I suspect I'm in the minority who actually likes to learn how these things work, they're complicated. And in the list of people's 15 biggest priorities, I think the arcane workings of learning how the mixed-member proportional system proposed for Ontario or single transferable vote works doesn't rate very high on many people's priorities. If you don't see a pressing problem, you vote with the status quo. So I think that's what explained it in Ontario. I just don't think it was in Ontario, it was almost a solution looking for a problem. I don't think people in Ontario saw that there was a big problem. BC, people saw a problem, and it came awfully close to passing.
I'm Trevor Page. Harold, thank you for your presentation. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about the compulsory voting system in Australia, how long it's been in effect, and whether any other countries in the developed world, and I'm thinking of Europe, have adopted that system. Thank you.
In Australia, it was 1924, so they've been using it for a long time. There have been some discussions in the last few years about maybe getting rid of it, but it seems pretty firmly ensconced. In Europe, the only country I'm aware of is Belgium that uses compulsory voting as well. There are about 40 countries that have it, but some countries don't enforce it, which means they don't really have it. If you're not going to enforce it, it doesn't mean much. But there are a number of prominent developing countries, like Brazil has it and enforces it as well. But Belgium is the other country that does, and all the countries that use it have very high voter turnout. If you want to look at the one magic wand solution to get people to vote, it's find them. That works quite well. It works to stop people from speeding, parking where they don't want to, and not voting. So yeah, we do. It has been used in a few other countries, but it hasn't been overwhelmingly popular. It's not something many countries do, and it's not an active debate in most countries. But yeah, I think you're going to see more discussion of it as voter turnouts continue to decline around the world.
My name's Douglas Mitchell. I'd just like to change gears a little bit. We've all been talking about provincial elections, and we're all waiting with bated breath for a federal election. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on how we can increase voter turnout here, and many of us feel we're in the same boat, that we're being led by the Conservatives, and maybe we don't like that too much. And I wonder if there's anything you would suggest we might do to combat this continual sweep of Alberta by the Conservatives.
Well, basically, it's the same problem, essentially. After the 1997 election, Jean-Pierre Kingsley, who was the previous chief electoral officer, actually said in an interview that he thought the time had come to open the debate on compulsory voting in Canada, and was roundly shot down by a lot of editorialists. Basically, there's not a lot we can do, although with the minority government situation, I think that opens up more options for getting parties to at least consider things like electoral reform. The NDP is the party that's sort of gone the furthest towards this, but even the NDP has been kind of ambivalent on it, actually, despite all the rhetoric to the contrary. We look at the fact that the provinces that have had NDP governments, like Saskatchewan and Manitoba, and even when they ran BC, they never did anything on electoral reform, despite the fact that they like to talk about it a whole lot. But once they're in power, things seem to change a little bit. As far as sort of concrete things, I don't really know what to tell you. It's all the same problems that we have in Alberta. It's frustrating. It's actually arguably even more frustrating, at least if you're voting in Lethbridge provincially. Both districts are fairly competitive and close, and your vote matters more here, arguably, than it does elsewhere. But federally, that's not the case, right? If you're a conservative supporter, we can help Rick Casson win by one more vote, right? Which he's already getting 70% of the vote. I don't know how many more he needs. And if you're an opposition party supporter, there's not much. I mean, the one thing you have, you know, federally that we don't have provincially is that your vote does contribute financially to a political party. Every vote is worth roughly about $1.80, $1.85 now to a political party, so it's kind of a donation. So at least there's some incentive to vote the way you want to. But basically, I think we need to look at the same kinds of things. I think we need to consider electoral reform. I think we also need to have that compulsory voting discussion at the national level as well. It's interesting, though, that the whole argument about competitiveness, the last election was close. We saw a change in government slightly. And we actually did see voter turnout increase after a series of declines. We saw voter turnout edge up closer to 65% again, which was reversed a series of four or five elections in a row where it declined. So I think as we're more competitive federally, you can see that competitiveness does seem to drive turnout a little bit. And if we continue to be competitive, maybe we'll sort of edge up some more. But it's the same problems, cultural problems and fixing the institutions that we face provincially.
Art Sanford and Dr. Jansen, very interesting talk. I have to agree with you that the voting turnout is a disgrace. But the other thing you might want to do someday is do a graph of the age groups that are voting, and you might get another shock. You're going to find out that a lot of the seniors get out to vote, and a lot of the young people do not. But I have, pardon me, just a couple of quick comments and then a question. I have real difficulty with proportional voting, because when I look around what is happening in some of the countries in the world, and Italy is a good example, they've had 61 governments in 62 years. And they're trying to elect government 62 right now, most of them coalition, dysfunctional governments. And can I play Paul Harvey and tell the other side of the story, what's happened in Belgium? Mm-hmm. Okay, Belgium elected a new government in June of 2007. Over there, they have a proportional voting, so anybody can get 2 or 3% of the vote gets somebody in parliament. The result is, in some of the constituencies, when you walked in to vote, there was 29 names on the ballot for 29 different parties. That group that were elected has now taken 9 months to try and put together a coalition. The old government's been running the government even though their mandate ran out. It's taken them 9 months until March the 10th of this year before five parties finally agreed they try to sit down and form a government. And I'm betting from 1 year from now you're going to say, what a dysfunctional government, what a mess they have. So sometimes you've got to take a very serious look, and sometimes you get, you know, what you wish for, you get what you get. So be careful. But the question I want to ask is a question. When you go to proportional voting, you quite often end up with a coalition government. What you end up with, and Calgary right now is having a bit of a problem with their ward system, what you end up with is people who represent, it's a government of communities. Nobody sees the greater picture. Each one fights for their own little area, and if I can't get what I want in my area, I'm not going to support you. So you end up with this kind of a mess, and that's why your governments keep failing when you see these coalition governments. Israel's had a problem with that, too, in some cases. But Italy is the worst example of all. So what I'd like you to address is this fact of this community government and who gets together to see the greater picture and put the pieces together where they belong so you can actually do something.
Three good points. The first one on voting, the age difference. You're absolutely right. Actually, the studies on the decline in voting show most of the decline in voting is generational. When I'm teaching my students, I always tell them, if you want to know why voter turnout is declining, the answer is really simple. I say, it's your fault. And I don't mean them personally. It's your generation. It's people under the age of 30. Absolutely. If we look, my generation was less likely to vote than my parents' generation. My students are less likely to vote than my generation. You're absolutely right. It's a generational replacement problem. And the studies tell us that younger voters are less informed and less interested, and that's a real problem. I agree, absolutely. That's where the issue is. As for the electoral reform question, the problem with coalition governments, I guess, yeah, there are absolutely countries where it doesn't work very well. and Italy and Israel are always two prime examples. Belgium's had issues, but many of them are also due to the deep cultural problems. For every country like that, there are the Sweden, the Germanys, the other countries, that the Austrias, that make this work pretty well. So if we look at the overall research, we find, well, what happens? Do you have governments that last less long under a proportional representation system? Absolutely. But the question is, does that mean they govern less well? And there have been some very good comparative studies that actually look at what governments actually do. And they find in terms of how they manage the economy, how they deal with welfare problems, a whole host of different measures and performance, there's actually zero difference. They both govern equally effectively. So you're right, we do have coalition governments, but the answer is they both govern quite effectively. And as far as not be of having frequent elections, I can point to a country that will remain nameless that seems mired in a series of minority governments right now and doesn't look like anyone's going to form a majority anytime soon. The great thing about Alberta for electoral reform, though, is that a lot of those arguments, we don't have to worry about them in Alberta, because even under a PR system, the Stelmach Conservatives still would have had a majority government. Even in 2004, where they had only 45% of the vote, they would have been only two or three seats shy, and as Stephen Harper's demonstrated, even when he's far quite a ways from that, it wouldn't have been very difficult for the Conservatives even to govern from 2004 to now, occasionally cooperating with the Alberta Alliance, occasionally cooperating with the Liberals. As far as the greater good question, the thing with our system right now is everybody, it's all geographic representation. MLAs are sort of trusted with representing people from their area. And when we get regional divisions, then the tendency for governments to write off particular regions becomes pretty strong. So we've seen the Conservatives in the past, Edmonton, until this last election, was kind of immune to the charms of Ralph Klein, it seemed. And to some extent, Edmonton kind of felt the wrath of the Conservatives, and it was very easy for them to write off Edmonton. Or we've seen it federally, Alberta always feels left out when there's a Liberal government. Same thing. Well, for the Liberals, why pay any attention to Alberta? Because no one's going to vote Liberal anyway. But if you have those votes actually matter, and you might actually elect three or four MPs from Alberta, or the Conservatives might have elected seven or eight MLAs from Edmonton, you can't just write off those regions. You have to reach out across the whole area. So I guess the hope is that you'd shift to some degree away from just geographic conceptions of representation to ones that cut across interests that aren't geographically defined, things that might be based on social class or other kinds of issues, that those kind of politics might become more important. But absolutely, in some countries, proportional representation hasn't worked well. I agree with you. But in a lot of countries, the single-member plurality system seems to work all right. In the United States, they have some issues with it, but it seems to work reasonably well in that context. With us, I think it's just not as good a fit.
We've got just over 5 minutes left, so if the questioners could keep things very brief, and we'll try and get through all three of you, and no more questions after James.
Hi, I'm Andy Davies. I'm a university student. One other thing is that to respond to yours, one of the things that helps keep those, you know, sort of 29-party issues not a problem is a minimum threshold of votes. So not everyone that gets a couple of votes ends up counting. So some of the countries have done that to bring it back to a reasonable number. I probably feel the same amount of sort of despair as most people following this last election. And I know that at our table, you know, there was discussion as to what the university students are doing and what kind of sort of movement would grow out of this. To me, the single biggest issue is how do we take this from preaching to the converted and having the same discussions and the same head nods and take that to the people that aren't in this room right now. So, to be honest, I'm at the point of just going door to door, literally between now and the next election, just at my own time. I mean, certainly I'm a New Democrat, but I would certainly not mention that on the doorstep. It would be absolutely apolitical and just say, you know, are you happy with the results? Have you thought about alternatives? And so I guess my question is, who's with me? And Harold, you're welcome to respond.
I'll just quickly say that at our table we were talking about the politics of how this moves forward and people saying, well, this is never going to happen. And you're right, governments don't like this. But I would have said that about British Columbia. I would have said that about New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, Ontario. I never thought I'd ever see any referendum on electoral reform in my lifetime, even though this is what I study and hope for. So it does happen. These things do work. So,
yeah. Okay.
My name is Van Christou. Thank you very much, Dr. Jansen, for the wake-up call to our lack of, our erosion of democracy here in Alberta. At our table, we talked about one of the factors that might be contributing to young people, particularly not being willing to go out and vote, is the fact that there's a dishonesty that's obvious to a lot of people, especially younger people, about the amount of money that's given to politicians under the table, and the disproportionate amount of money that some politicians get donated before the election, where it isn't a level playing field and a fair situation. Do you think that it's possible that we could eliminate donations to parties at all, and that that all the parties get an equal amount of money, public money, and that's all they can spend? Is that a possibility? And don't you think that would bring back a lot more faith into the entire process?
Wow, you just asked a question about my research, which means I could talk about 2 hours on this one. I won't. Time's limited, and we've got one more question. So I'll briefly say, I mean, there's some merit to that, and the moves federally to ban corporate and union donations and put that $1,100 limit on individual donations moves us largely in that direction. The danger, though, is that the fear is that what this does to political parties, if they're entirely dependent on the state for funding, part of the way you keep parties responsive to and connected to society is through those financial ties. Part of the reason the Canadian Alliance knew it was in trouble is the money dried up. People stopped giving money to them when Stockwell Day was leader, and they knew, we got to get rid of the Stockwell Day guy. He's killing us, right? If parties are getting money from the taxpayers, and basically it's not tied to what people want, then one of those signals for how they're connecting to society is gone. So, I mean, I agree with you. I think we absolutely need to do something about this. I don't know if I'd go quite that far, but I think we need to. That's a mechanism we definitely need to explore. I wish I had more time, but that's all the time we've got.
My name is James Moore. I've got a question for you, sir, about plutocracy. You know, we're all talking about democracy and pretty positive group here, but at the same time, there's 35 corporate CEOs speaking to the executive level of the three North American governments. We have the Tillman Agreement. Example of all of the new production in the tar sands, every company from 1 million now up to 3 million barrels per day is shipping it all as bitumen to the United States, and under the NAFTA agreement, we aren't able to roll that back, neither in proportion nor in the fact that it's bitumen. So while we, every 4 years or 3 years, have this discussion and are hopeful for our democracy, you know, all during all of those 3 years, the plutocracy is very, very busy working at the executive level on its agenda. Can you comment on our chances?
Do you always ask everyone these nice, easy questions? Like, that's huge. I can't really answer that in a really quick point. But I guess the point I'll make is that does tie into some of the institutional kinds of things, like the question on party finance, on making sure that the people who vote. So, like, the thing that sort of counteracts money is everybody has a vote, rich or poor. But if people who are poor are disproportionately not voting, we need to look at why that's the case, and that's one of the great leveling things, and that, I think, is one of the arguments in favor of compulsory voting, is that it helps to at least reduce some of the class disparities in voter turnout, and that might lead to some sort of improvement. The finance laws, I think, are important, the corporate ties, the financial ties, and they are pretty considerable between corporate elite in Alberta and the conservative government here. I think we do need to deal with those things as well. And until we do those, it's really difficult to tackle some of the other things. If our government, which has to provide leadership on some of these things, is beholden through its institutional ties to particular groups, it's difficult to address them. So I think those basic political institutional questions do need to be dealt with before we can even begin a discussion about those other big things. But yeah, that's a huge question, and when it's the last one and we're over time already, I can't do any more than whip out on that one.
Thank you so very much for coming and speaking with us today, and thanks everyone for being here and for listening. And I know there's a lot more discussion you could have. Go to the website. Try the discussion board. See how it works out. And we'll see you next time. Thanks.